Welcome, and thank you for joining us for the NAHU Healthcare Happy Hour, the official podcast of the National Association of Health Underwriters. Before we begin, please take a moment to subscribe to our podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or Spotify. The podcast is distributed on these platforms every Friday and is included in the NAHU's weekly member-exclusive health policy newsletter, The Washington Update, giving you a head start on your weekly healthcare happy hour. We apologize for the audio quality on this week's episode of the Healthcare Happy Hour. We are practicing social distancing and recording in our individual homes.
The Supreme Court issued a ruling Monday demanding Congress keep its promise to pay insurers $12 billion in unpaid ACA funds. The 8-to-1 decision means that Congress must provide the funds it had promised through the Risk Corridor program in order to insure consumers on the exchanges who hadn't been previously insured or had been considered uninsurable. On this week's episode of the Healthcare Happy Hour, Marcy reviews the ruling and its implications. Marcy, can you provide some background on the case? What is the Risk Corridor program?
Sure, Dan. So this week, we're obviously taking a little bit of a break from some of our COVID-19 coverage, and the Supreme Court has reminded us that there are still other issues out there, and they did so by releasing this decision on Maine Community Health Options versus the United States. And as Dan mentioned, this has to do with the Risk Corridor program that was put into place in the ACA. The Risk Corridor program essentially, obviously it's very complicated, but essentially it was put in place to help get insurers to participate in the marketplaces and the exchanges and to offer qualified health plans. So this was one of three premium stabilization programs. One was this temporary Risk Corridor program to be in place for plan years 2014, 2015, and 2016. The other was the temporary reinsurance program. And then the last was the permanent risk adjustment program. So those were the three premium stabilization programs that were put into place. And the Risk Corridor program really would provide funds to insurers if they took on more risk than they had projected for that year. So when we look at this kind of historically and how the years lined up with when this passed and when it went into place, and then the decision to limit those funds, that's how we get to the $12 billion that they are saying are due to insurers through those risk corridor payments. So the Risk Corridor program was in the ACA, but again, didn't go into place until that 2014 plan year. And at that time, when insurers were trying to put together their plans for the 2014 plan year, kind of go back in time and think about the spring, summer of 2013, which is when those plans would have been finalized. And insurers are going into this new market that they haven't been in before. There is a lot of uncertainty about who is going to go into the marketplaces, what type of individuals are going to make up this pool. And the insurers presented their plans, had their plans approved for 2014, did their premium pricing. And then after that, the announcement was made by the Obama administration to provide transitional relief for grandmothered plans. So those are those, if you like your plan, you can keep it plans, as President Obama said at the time. And the insurers put their plans together thinking that those grandmother plans were going to go away. And so this hurt the ACA rollout and caused insurers to take on more of a risk because so many people stayed on their grandmother plans that really what we saw going into the marketplaces was a worse combination of individuals than insurers had really planned. So right off the bat, they're already hurting financially and really in need of these payments as they were set out in the ACA.
What were the central questions in this lawsuit?
The three main points that were being litigated were whether the government had an obligation under the ACA to make the risk corridor payments, whether Congress could set aside these obligations retroactively and through the appropriations process, and then finally, whether the insurers could sue the federal government for damages. So when we go back to those first two questions, the first about whether the government had an obligation under the ACA to make these payments. So the court goes through and they look at the language specifically in the ACA. And this is the language that provided funds for the risk corridor payment. And they also make reference to the fact that these payments were not required to be budget neutral. What that means is even if the funds coming into the program aren't enough to satisfy the payments that need to go out, that the government would have to provide those funds to go out. So not budget neutral. And this is a very important part of the language and the intent of putting the risk corridor program into place when we get to why this is in litigation now. They also look at the wording in the ACA. Loyal listeners know I always talk about how words matter. And in the ACA, when they're talking about the risk corridor program, they use the terms that the government shall pay. So the court looked at this and they compare it to other areas in the ACA that were optional. And in some of those areas, the ACA uses language like the Secretary of HHS may develop or may do this. And so they determined that where the ACA uses the term may, that's an optional thing to be done. But if it says shall, that is something that the government has to do, or that's something that has to be done. And again, here where it says the government shall pay, it does not say subject to availability of appropriation. So that's just further guidance and support that the intent was that this was not to be budget neutral. And that was also included in some of the language that came out from the agencies after the ACA was passed and signed into law by President Obama. So those are some of the pieces that go into what they're looking at to try to answer the questions about whether the government had the obligation under the ACA to make the payment. And then when they get to the next question about whether Congress could set aside those obligations, that goes to the decision that was made in December 2014 by Congress, where they essentially used an appropriations bill to cap the spending for the Risk Corridors program and to make a change so that the Risk Corridor program did have to be budget neutral. So the court goes into this and basically says that even though Congress passed this appropriation bill in December of 2014, they can't repeal statutory obligations through appropriations riders, which is where this kind of cap, so to speak, on the program was put in that December 2014 bill. And that sort of implied repeal is not something that can be upheld. They also point to the fact that Congress tried and failed to pass clear language that would require this program to be budget neutral. And so the court looks at this and says, basically, Congress, you tried to pass this bill to cap the funding. You tried to pass a bill that would make this program have to be budget neutral, but you didn't. No one signed on to that. There wasn't support for that. And so by trying to sneak the caps in on the program and a budget appropriation rider that does not have clear language, you're just trying to imply a repeal of this and those payments. You can't do that. That's not a clear way of changing the statutory obligation for the government to pay out in these risk corridor payments. So that's where the court kind of draws the line and says Congress acted unlawfully by trying to change the statutory obligation for the federal government to make these payments, and that these payments should have and do need to go out to the insurers to the tune of about $12 billion in risk corridor payments that weren't made because of the ineffective implied repeal from that 2014 appropriations bill. Justice Sotomayor, who wrote the opinion for the 8 judges in the majority, she writes that this is really a principle as old as the nation itself. the government should honor its obligation. And that really sets the tone for the entirety of the court's opinion.
What does this decision mean for insurers and consumers?
This decision means that they are going to figure out how to distribute this $12 billion, which is a process all in itself. Many folks are looking at this and thinking, if the insurers get the $12 billion, obviously a different number depending on the insurer and what their risk was, that this money will then trickle down in rebate payment to health insurance consumers. But I wouldn't be running out to wait by the mailbox for my rebate check just yet, because this is going to take quite some time. There are a number of different issues that go into this, and there are also a number of other lawsuits that are related to the risk corridor program that are still waiting to be litigated. Another issue is with some of these insurers, they're going to have to really look and put together a new determination of who is actually going to qualify for any money that ends up going back out from the federal government as a result of this. So some insurance companies that were active for the 2014 to 2016 time in the marketplace exchanges selling qualified health plans are no longer selling QHPs. They're not working in those markets anymore. So are they able to recoup this? There are some companies and many of the co-ops that fell into this. We all remember the days of the co-ops, which have almost all but become extinct. Many of those co-ops fell victim financially because of the way that they put together their premiums and the fact that they were not given much of this risk corridor payment that they had been counting on to be able to sustain themselves in the longer term. And not only co-ops, there are also some other health insurance companies that have completely folded as a result of this. So they're no longer in existence as an entity, but they would have been entities that would have received this money had Congress not tried to limit the payout of the risk corridor program funds. So there are a lot of questions about how that $12 billion could possibly end up in the hands of insurers, in the hands of consumers. What this case does is it sends this decision to the Court of Federal Claims, and that court will issue a judgment for each insurer and a ruling against HHS. And then HHS has to ask the Financial Management Service, which is an entity within the Department of Treasury, to request a certification of payment from the judgment fund. And the Financial Management Service, they are the ones that administer the judgment fund, and they determine whether a judgment is final, and they make direct payment to the party receiving the funds. Some of these other cases that are challenging different aspects from the risk corridor payment program, if they're still ongoing, then the Financial Management Service may not think that this is a final judgment, which could hold up the funds even further. Once all of that is finally determined and they identify which entities should receive funds, how much they should receive, and it goes through that Financial Management Service, then the payments will go directly to the different insurers. And then this brings us to another question on how all of this is going to impact the market. Many are looking at this and are trying to determine exactly how this influx of money will affect insurers and possibly affect their medical loss ratio. So remember, the medical loss ratio requires 80 or 85%, depending on the market, of the premium dollar to go towards health insurance claims, and then the other to go towards administrative costs. And if they don't meet that ratio, the insurers have to rebate the difference to the health insurance consumers. So a lot of folks, like I said, are looking at this and trying to figure out how these funds, going back to the insurers, how they'll be counted and whether it will count as them having a higher profit margin for that year and for that to count for a future year and go to consumers that are enrolled now, or if it needs to go back and go to those consumers who are actually the most burdened by all of this, which are the enrollees from 2014, 2015, and 2016, although that's actually the least likely to occur, even though those were the folks that were enrolled in the plans that had higher premiums increasing vastly because insurers were trying to cover for the shortfall of funds they were not receiving from the risk corridor program. So there is just a big question mark on how the funds are going to end up being distributed, whether this is going to affect an insurer's MLR, whether these funds will eventually end up in the consumer's pockets, whether it will be a consumer that is enrolled in a plan now, or if it will actually reach those that were in plan during that time. There are also questions that perhaps HHS will issue new regulations or at least some type of guidance to address the Supreme Court's decision and how insurers would account for those payments and how it might affect the MLR.
Does this ruling tell us anything about what we can expect for future ACA cases?
Well, I would like to say so, but I'm not sure that it does. So this is probably one of the clearest decisions that we've had on any of the ACA cases in the Supreme Court, this being an 8-1 decision, pretty groundbreaking there. All of the other ACA cases that have come before the Supreme Court have been 5-4 decisions, so very narrowly decided. And of course, the next big decision that they're going to have, or the next big case they're hearing, is that Texas v. United States case about if the individual mandate is rendered unconstitutional and taken out as the rest of the ACA can stand on its own. And so really looking at the viability of the ACA overall. And I just don't think we're going to have an 8-1 decision when we have that. But what it does tell us is that the Supreme Court is moving along as best as they can under the current circumstances, under this pandemic. They have announced that they will be hearing oral arguments by telephone over 6 days in May. So we do know that they are going to continue on. Although this decision doesn't really provide the guidance to feel out what we think a decision could be on Texas v. United States, it does allow us to know that there will be a decision on Texas v. United States and that they are moving forward and trying to set a schedule to be able to hear the cases on their docket for 2020.
It's now time for the NAHU Healthcare Happy Hour Toast of the Week. Marcy, who are we toasting to this week?
This week, we're toasting to the Department of Labor and IRS for integrating many of our suggestions that we gave them to help provide relief for employers and individuals so that they can maintain or obtain health insurance coverage during this time. If you'd like to learn more about the suggestions that we provided the agencies, you can listen to the April 10th Healthcare Happy Hour podcast. Or if you'd like to know more about the guidance that came out from the Department of Labor and IRS, you can listen to our Compliance Corner webinar from April 30th, available in the webinar section of our website, nahu.org.
Cheers!
Thank you for joining us for the NAHU Healthcare Happy Hour, the official podcast of the National Association of Health Underwriters. For more information on NAHU's government affairs efforts or to become a member, visit nahu.org.